All right, well, the panel's topic is where to from here on the web. And I'll let Russell Brown, moderator, to formally introduce it, but we have Steve Champion, Doug Bauman, Kelly Gozo, and Joel Spolsky.
I like my discussions informal. What I'll do is bring all four panelists in with one question, then we'll go from there. I'm sure we'll have some time at the end for questions from the floor, so just hold on till then, unless you have something you really have to ask, and then just thrust your hand in the air and hopefully we'll see you.
Or just get on the floor so that we can take questions from the floor.
If you like, you know, introduce yourself and say what you do and where you're from. That's always helpful with the answers. Doug, there you are. I talked earlier on about engineering begetting culture, and that seems to me to be something of great relevance to you, because as the designer of Blogger templates, you're actually shaping the way that tens of millions of people express themselves. I mean, do you lie awake at night worrying about the responsibility of that? Do we blame you?
It's all my fault. Quite a phenomenon, really. I knew it might be kind of a big thing, but when we first... Can you hear me okay? When I was asked to do some templates for Blogger, I kind of thought it would be a cool project, and we'll get to suddenly have what I thought thousands of people possibly using standards-compliant templates all around the globe. I didn't realize it would be hundreds of thousands or millions. The only thing I really feel the really impact of is that they left my domain in the source code of the template. So I get probably 10 to 20 emails a day asking, why is this column floating down to the right-hand side, and things like that. But the impact, I think, was that it really did kind of introduce a lot of standardized and web standards, standard compliant templates to the masses. And I've seen lots of variations on those templates as well that kind of spread far even beyond what Blogger offers. So WordPress users have adopted them, and Six Apart templates have kind of made use of them. So it's really kind of strange to see them spread far and wide. And I see examples that appear on TV every now and then.
Were there any elements of it that if you had your chance again, you'd do differently? Is there anything that went the wrong way?
There's several things that I think we did wrong that I learned as soon as we finished the project. One is that I didn't get enough of a varied group of designers to contribute. I asked five designers that I knew who could crank them out, because we only had 2 weeks to do them, so they could actually crank out a design and turn it into standards compliant HTML and CSS within basically a week's time. So I get a varying group of designers. Also, just the whole structure and standardizing the structure, as I talked about yesterday morning. I'd make that standard from the get-go, and I'd really encourage the Blogger team to separate their structure and their style, because right now they're merged basically into one template, so there's really no chance to change those intervariably, so things like that.
Have you identified user needs for the next generation of templates? Is there something new that's come up that you're going to have to allow for? People's behavior does evolve, doesn't it?
First of all, I should probably specify and use this opportunity while you're asking me about Blogger stuff to make an announcement, because I kind of have to clarify that my answers don't necessarily represent the view of my employer, because I just started a job with Google last week as their visual design lead for some of their CCC products. So the opinions I'm expressing here certainly are my own, and sure, I can't necessarily speak for Google. But there certainly is a need for a lot more templates, because there's exponentially more people blogging now, and more need for expression and personality, and more need for customization of those templates. And obviously it's not just the Blogger platform, but all of these. So more flexibility for different types of content, photos, music. People are using blogging for all different kinds of purposes. It's not just about writing stories about their cats and their dogs. Just a lot more variety in terms of people's style and taste. And actually, some of the most successful templates were the very simplest ones that people could go and customize and change very, very quickly, or the ones that let their own personality show through, rather than a template that, say, for example, had a very specific type of personality. So the very general kind of loose templates actually work a lot better for users.
Right. Kelly, on that theme of change, we seem to be seeing really rapid cycling at the moment. Things coming in from the margins really quickly. I mean, blogging's a good example. We went from this thing that a few thousand people did to, you know, the CEO of General Motors having a blog. We've had YouTube, you know, coming in from nowhere in 11 months. Podcasting, all these things. What do you think is going on here? What, you know, these things are rushing in from the margins and becoming essential. What is actually happening?
Well, it's been interesting living in San Francisco. So Doug and I and others, we have lived there, we've moved away, we've seen the bubbles come and burst. So innovation seems to take this bubbled effect where you have a new technology and it kind of goes back, and it's sort of funny because we've been talking about this, about how 100 years ago the industrial revolution came and steam engines started, but people didn't quite know what to do with the new technologies. So people knew that they had something great, but they didn't know what to do with it. So in the last 10 years, it's just starting, the cycles are going faster and faster and faster. And as the new technologies pop up, we're thinking, wow, what can we do with it? So this great amount of brainstorming occurs, and we try and hit people's needs over and over again. So 10 years ago it started, and it burst, and we had a five-year lapse, and now it's starting again, focusing on our need to socialize, I think, is a lot of it. And so the revolution that's happening right now, and I sort of mentioned it as we were talking about Flickr and kind of the mobile mashups and the web mashups and everything that's happening, is people are taking the tools that are being utilized in their regular lives and applying it to business, applying it to their personal life, their social life, their sporting life, their news and information. And so people are personalizing their lives using technology. And so you can take that to another level, and of course, you're starting to see these trends that are happening globally, and then you can kind of parse them out into what's happening culturally, and for whatever reasons, they're popular. So as we're seeing, you know, like I was showing Nike and iPod kind of merging, there's going to be more and more mergings of these great technologies and sort of things that apply to your regular lives. And then in the next 2 years, maybe even 6 months or 12 months, it's all going to fall off, and just the most relevant things are going to stay. So it's pretty exciting.
But because the thing that interests me is that maybe the Nike iPod one's an exception, but in general, these aren't ideas cooked up in anyone's boardroom. They're actually coming from the fringe.
Right.
You know, Rupert Murdoch didn't have the idea of social networking. He paid $500 million and bought MySpace.
Right.
Well, why do these things emerge that way?
Well, it's open garden, walled garden concepts, and that's why there was such a request when we were sitting there and Bill Gates was giving his big presentation. Everyone said, please open it up so that other people can get involved. And so we have technologies that people can actually grab and utilize and brainstorm on, and a piece or a tool that can be used for something that they can think of on their own. So instead of the big conglomerates owning everything, it's becoming something that's ubiquitous and we can all kind of contend with. The difficulty of that is trying to figure out where we're going to make money. Mm. So, you know, as an example of the grassroots kind of community, we were at an event in Vegas, the same event, and Tontek and a few others, Eric Meyer, they said, hey, everyone, let's meet in the food court. And we're going to talk about microformats. And Doug touched on that in his presentation first day. And it was really exciting to be there because inherently microformats aren't super exciting to me personally, because it's not that I think about that every day. But what was exciting is that this is coming from the fringe. It's people speaking up saying, hey, I have an idea. And if we really merge our voices and our strength in the industry, we can make this into something that's actually going to affect every single person in the world. But we have to start here and now, and I feel like I was somehow privileged to be a part of that very beginning of the conversation, really from the grassroots level.
Right. Steve, do you listen to all these new ideas and think, new forms of abuse?
It's funny. When I first got on the net and first registered my very first domain name, you still had to FTP a template. It was a text file template down from the internet, which was still one thing. You had to fill it out. Eventually, they made it so that you could PGP encrypt it. Usually, all these tools were all command line driven and so on and so forth. People talk about September 1993 is a September that never ended. The joke was, and it came out of Usenet, the idea was that back in the day, the only people who had internet access were large corporations or people working for large corporations and universities. And every year, at the beginning of the school year, they had to absorb a new wave of people who didn't know anything about the communities they were getting ready to join. They didn't know anything about the social values that were basically reflective of the class of people that built the internet. Most of the people that were on in the early days were engineers. They worked for large corporations or for the military. They were all pretty much somewhere in the middle. You know, you didn't have a lot of lower class folks. You didn't have a lot of CEOs on the net. They were all pretty much people who, if something was broken, they could fix it in order to finish what they were doing. And people talk about the September that never ended when AOL opened up to Usenet, because it used to be that people would adapt, adjust, be taught, be educated by the people who knew the values of the communities and passed them on to the new folks, and after a while people would settle down. And with the expansion of access and availability of internet technologies to pretty much anybody who could afford to pay, you know, $7 a month or something at net zero, we've lost a certain kind of leverage that they used to have. People would gear up for the September and teach everybody, and then by November it would be more or less calmed down. And we lost the opportunity to do that in 94?
AOL opened up
to Usenet.
93 or 94, yeah.
But that's just illustrative of a larger concept, which is that we went from a situation where people largely knew each other, had worked together, extended their reach, basically building new connections, but also firming up existing connections to people they already knew and could probably relate to. With the world opening up to pretty much anybody who can be on the net, suddenly you have to worry about, in addition to the whole, let's see if we can teach, you know, another 50 people a day how to use plain text email properly and not, you know, top post and so on and so forth. I'm trying to figure out if anybody here is on Web Design L by fishing for a top posting thing. But it's one thing that I've been doing with my list is trying to pass those values on, trying to say, look, it's about communication. If you post something and wrap it at 72 characters a line in plain text, and when you reply, you trim out all the garbage, the people using the digest will be able to use it in an effective manner without all the noise and so on and so forth. And I get roundly lambasted whenever it comes up, because I'm basically seen as this dinosaur. You know, I choose to use Mutt, this terminal-based client, and, you know, I can't read HTML email. I have to basically save it to a different mailbox and then download it in Mac Mail and see if it's anything I really care about. You know, stuff from my mom. On AOL, exactly. And but one of the side effects of that openness, which is part of what is driving the innovation and driving the creativity and driving the ability for people to come up with an idea and have, you know, 10 million users in the space of a couple of years, is that open access. So there's always going to be a tension between the need for, you know, we'll call it universal internet access, and the need to help socialize folks. One of the problems with that, you know, you could look at SMTP, for example. 5 or 6 years ago, every SMTP server in the world would pretty much accept the message from any other SMTP server in the world, even though it was a message addressed to someone on a totally different SMTP server. Spammers quickly learned that that could be abused, and community values were basically, either with stick or carrot, changed so that now it's very difficult, or it's very rare to find an open relay. And I think what we're going to find out is it's an arms race, really. Everything that you create will find new forms of abuse. They introduced JavaScript, which made all these great applications possible, and at the same time made it possible to do cross-site scripting attacks on, you know, innocent victims who were even more naive than the first round of AOL users. AOL users, I just want to hear that. Laugh again. But seriously, I mean, you're looking at a much more representative sample of all of the different types of people in the world. And, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, you could say that most of the people on Usenet, except the kooks, were basically rational, well-educated, middle-class engineer types and so on and so forth. And that's obviously, you know, a pipe dream now. And we have to be prepared to let the openness continue, but to also kind of lower our basic trust in human nature as a defense, and it's tough. I mean, spam, I talk about email spam, but spam didn't start in email. Spam started on Usenet. when we get good enough at blocking it on email, you know, it'll go to instant messaging, it'll go to text messaging, it'll go anywhere else. You know, so you just have to.
Do you still use Usenet? Because most of the people I know who started off using it don't go there anymore.
I still read it. I was never really a prolific poster. I mean, I still read like alt.sysadmin.recovery because it just makes me feel like I'm not alone.
Joel, everyone here is mostly operates as an individual or a small company. There's a lot of personal brands going around. We've talked about the influence of individuals. I thought Tony Chaw made a pretty good effort at saying we're listening on behalf of Microsoft, but it's almost interesting that he had to say, hey, look, we're still in the game. We're catching up.
Yeah.
What influence do you think corporate IT, and particularly Microsoft, is going to have on the web in the next few years?
It's really strange because it feels like when I go to conferences like this, conferences like eTech, and O'Reilly, Web 2.0, when you look at the innovation that's happening in Ajax, new web applications, new websites, new forms of content, new forms of applications, so little of that innovation seems to have anything to do with Microsoft. It's unbelievable. The idea that somebody would build something on IIS, although we actually do, is rather extravagant. But you know, to give a specific example about building things on IIS, we're considering building an appliance that will have certain software pre-installed on it. And to use Windows as that operating system adds $900 to the cost of that product. And to use Linux as that operating system is zero. So for a single website that's hosted, it's a negligible cost spread across your millions of users. On the other hand, to build a Google with I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of servers, or to build a product that you're going to make into consumer electronics and ship and have to pay a licensing fee is something that people don't even consider anymore. And one of the things that I've noticed around the consulting market is how much mindshare Microsoft lost when they weren't paying attention to the internet. And in particular, if you were to go out today and try to find a comm programmer.
Well, they continue to lose every time they stop paying attention to the internet.
Yeah.
It comes in waves.
There have been a couple of waves of this. So if you were to go out today and try to find a programmer that can write comm code or ATL code, you probably couldn't afford to hire them because they wouldn't want to work on comm anymore because they're so senior by now. The people that still remember this technology from 10 years ago are so senior now. When they talked about browser helper objects as an add-in strategy for Internet Explorer, that requires comm. And that's something that right now you literally cannot find people on the market that are willing to understand that or to work with that. Whereas if you compare that to Firefox, which has a model of extensions that are written in JavaScript, and there's scrillions of them, and they're very easy to turn on and turn off, there's been a real loss of mindshare, I think, in Microsoft. And so they've kind of gotten stuck in the industrial, I don't want to say the lawnmower market. It's just not really that exciting. Washers and dryers, Office, Windows, the mouse.
And yet, on the other hand, the mouse. On the other hand, there seem to be these big poster child type projects that are based on the standards based technologies. I'm a media guy. I was really excited about the BBC putting its catalog since the year dot online, used Ruby on Rails.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's going to continue, that there are these things waiting to happen that are being enabled by web standards?
Things waiting to happen, sometimes there are and sometimes there aren't. I actually think that when you see a new technology come out, let's say it's Ruby on Rails or some new product that somebody comes out with, the way I kind of look at whether it's going to succeed is, were people trying to do that in some much, much worse way? In other words, you have to see, is there a natural demand there for that kind of thing? And was there a horrible way that people were doing that? So, for example, there always was demand for the local Albuquerque, New Mexico newspaper in New York City. And the only way you could get it is to have a very expensive subscription airmailed to you several days later, or to go to one or two newsstands that specialized in out-of-town newspapers. And the demand was for people that were from Albuquerque and wanted to read about the local politics before they went back, or for people who were going to move to Albuquerque and wanted to find a job or a house in the classified section. Suddenly that goes on the web, and there was an existing demand, there was an existing pain. The pain goes away, and you suddenly understand this new technology will work. When you hear about a new technology that doesn't seem to be addressing something that people are trying to do badly, in some other mechanism. That's kind of what I would consider the brave new world technology, this new kind of scary. Most of the social networking sites, which you might think are really very innovative or very new, or the idea of whether it's MySpace, Friendster, LinkedIn, that seem like these kind of hot new ideas, are really only kind of automations of the process of something that people have been trying to do with very little success, i.e. getting laid. and suddenly it's become easier, there's a new technology for doing it, and that's why those were successful.
Yeah, I mean, there's actually a really good example in there. Friendster failed, MySpace succeeded. Well, why did that happen, Kelly?
Oh, well, it doesn't necessarily have to do with usability, because MySpace isn't really that usable, just like eBay isn't really that usable. It just has to do with critical mass. So Craigslist is something that's very popular that started off in San Francisco, and then it extended into many different cities. And Craigslist, they tried to do a redesign of it. Cameron Moll led that effort, and they did this at South by Southwest, and they ended up not changing the technology too much because people generally just want simple information. But the reason why Craigslist is popular and why MySpace works is because of the critical mass that's happened, and that is the success of it. It's definitely not the site itself, the technology, or the usability of it, right? And eBay, it's very much the same thing. So who knows why that happens? Word of mouth, tribe culture, communities starting to get online and encouraging other people. Ofoto started originally, and pretty much everyone had to sign up and log in order to view photos. That wasn't ideal, but it was the only service out there. Other companies like Shutterfly, and then finally Flickr came, and you didn't have to sign up in order to view people's pictures. That was preferred. But everyone had an Ofoto account, and so Kodak bought them and continued that route for a long time. But people don't want to register and sign up before they can view pictures, and that's really now the norm, and so that's a reason why people have migrated away from that type of format. But when you have the only system out there, then you have a monopoly. Right. So,
Steve, were you going to?
Oh, yeah, I was just going to point out, one of the things that really surprised me, we were friends with the folks that put together Six Apart and Movable Type and so on and so forth. We knew the guys from Blogger. When anyone set up a blog, we just assumed that they were using Blogger or Movable Type. And later WordPress came along, and there's a whole, you know, very active and very, you know, almost rabidly loyal community built up around WordPress. And I understand why. I mean, the support and the documentation is so well written and so accessible. Whereas most of our friends, I mean, we're from North Carolina, and there's a very large technical community in North Carolina, and all of our friends use LiveJournal. Right, and it's very strange for us because we have lots of friends that are all around the country and in San Francisco, or you know, moved out to San Francisco during the bubble and then moved back or up or over to Portland or something like that, and they're all using, you know, some tool or another, or they're hosting it on, you know, it doesn't really matter. They're hosting it in Texas and they live in Portland or whatever, and the LiveJournal folks, all of our friends, all of the sysadmins we know and all of the tech geeks we know are all on LiveJournal because that's where all their friends are.
You know. One of the critical things that happened to Friendster, which is something that will often happen on social sites for teenagers and for kids, is that nobody wants to be using the same technology that their older siblings uses. And so certain, you know, MTV and Nickelodeon will go in waves. MTV is targeted at, I guess, 11 to 13-year-olds, believe it or not. And Nickelodeon is targeted for, you know, slightly younger than that, but not a whole lot. And then there's VH1 targeted at slightly older. And they'll tend to see these waves because if the kids are watching MTV, their little brothers are not going to want to watch the same thing. They're not going to want to listen to the same music. You can always tell the clueless tech commentators because they'll use Britney Spears as an example of a quote-unquote popular musician. And actually, the kids are onto this new thing called emo. I don't even know what it is. I can't even tell. But Britney Spears, it is not. That is not what the kids are listening to today. It's not what they're wearing. So those fashion things go in these really strong waves. And when something like Friendster or MySpace becomes kind of hip, it runs an incredible risk of kind of running away. Even when it appears to have a network effect, it keeps people there. And so there isn't such a strong network effect with MySpace as there is with eBay. With eBay, you wouldn't want to sell your goods anywhere else. I mean, the same reason they basically don't have eBay in New Zealand, and the same reason Amazon and Microsoft's eBay products never took off. You don't want to sell your goods in a market that has, you know, 1/10 as many or 1/100 as many people. And so you get locked into that because this is a good financial reason. On the other hand, the things which are purely stylistic or style or fashion will tend to move in rapid waves. And so the successful brands in fashion will have a list of brands. You know, if you go and look at the corporate ownership, you'll see that there are about 18 different brands behind The Gap, Banana Republic, a whole set of those brands, and Old Navy. And something similar will happen. Abercrombie is the Limited and Nine West, and I don't even know what other ones. So you have to, from a business perspective, you have to understand that there's going to be trends that are going to come and go.
I think we've established that, you know, by looking at MySpace and Craigslist, which is really difficult to look at,
so is Craig. So.
Yeah, right. your work doesn't have to be beautiful and efficient and standards-based to succeed. And yet, I'm sure in this room there is a feeling about the right way. You know, there is a right way. There is a non-evil way of doing things. I'm interested in who drives it. I mean, for example, there's a lot of public sector people in this room. Are you seeing evidence anywhere else that, you know, the public sector sets, you know, becomes an exemplar, sets an example?
No.
No. Would you like to see it happen?
The truth is that there was actually Jeffrey Zeldman, who is a big web standards advocate, did a project on web standards for the New York Public Library that to this day is sort of a source or a reference, a piece of reference material that has driven that. And one of the great things about the public sector is that the public sector is used to imposing top-down rules, and they really like it when they're told to do something exactly this way. If there's a procedure book that has absolute requirements and tests that you can run to find out whether or not you're passed, this is so natural to the public sector as opposed to the private sector, which is more pragmatic, just wants to get things done, that things like web standards are very easy to drive from the public sector.
Well, it's interesting. Let me just add real quick. I mean, our company, we do a lot of work with nonprofits, with educational institutions, and by nonprofit, I don't mean charity. I mean basically people who work in support of a mission that is funded, whether they get it through grants or they get it through a more member-driven model. And we find that in situations like that, and if anybody was there during Heather's talk this afternoon, you'll recognize this, that there are certain constraints that are imposed on you in any market or any kind of institutional framework. Heather talked a lot about how we have to deal with the fact that it's a year cycle in setting budgets and setting the goals for the organization for the next, you know, time period, whatever that time period may be. And it's important, regardless of what institution or, you know, framework or group that you're part of, to understand those constraints and sort of custom tailor your approach to meet those constraints. Because if you try to, say, turn a 500-year-old university publisher into a fleet-footed, you know, venture-backed something or other, it's not going to work. There's going to be resistance from all sectors of the organization, and vice versa. It's not going to work. So it's just best to understand the nature of the sector that you're in and address, you know, your approach to that.
Mm-hmm. How about geography? Are there territories that are more receptive to the web standards movement than others?
Well, I know that I wrote a few things for WebMonkey, which aren't necessarily strictly web standards based, but I think they assume web standards from the start and build on it. And for those of you who used to read WebMonkey and noticed when it went away for a while, during the time that WebMonkey wasn't publishing any new articles, we were actually getting requests from Japan from people who were translating the existing WebMonkey archive into Japanese, and they had some sort of, Lycos had some sort of contract with WebMonkey Japan or Lycos Japan, Hotwire Japan, to provide content. And they figured, well, we've got all this other content that's been produced that's still relevant, and they spent a couple of years just translating that content. So I know that there's a lot of interest in it in Japan. The CSS book that I worked on was actually translated into Italian. I don't know if that means anything or not, but.
Well, I mean, everyone talks about China being the force. China's going to be full of Linux desktops. It's not going to want proprietary software. Are we actually seeing that? You know, is it actually going to be the kind of influence that people have predicted?
Well, I have a thought.
How to answer?
So just an answer to the China market. There was an interesting stat that helped me really visualize the Chinese market as maybe compared to the U.S. market. and that is looking at the youth group. So youth is huge, and it's very money generating. So in China, there's 20 times the amount of youth between 12 and 18 years old as there are in the U.S. So you think, wow, huge revenue market. But the average spending for a Chinese person that is of that age is, anyone guess what the average per year spending is for someone 12 to 18 in China? So it's about $89. Wow. In the U.S., even though there is 1/20th of the amount of people, guess what the average spending is between 12 and 18 in the U.S.? Anyone? 5,000. Someone said 5,000. It's 4,900. So it's a huge change in understanding what the economies of scale are. And we're working with a company right now in China, and they have an earning of about $300,000 a year, and that for them puts them in the top tier of usability and research firms in that country. And for us, that would be not very much revenue. So you have to understand economies of scale, and although there's a ton of people, and yes, there's a lot of money there because of the amount of people, the average spending and the way that they spend their money is really different.
How much work is going into usability in non-English languages?
Oh.
Because, I mean, Public Address has published a few things in Chinese text.
I mean,
and I'm amazed that we can do it. But, I mean, how much is actually going on there?
I mean, that's a loaded question. There's a lot of companies here where you would hope that there's a lot of a lot happening in usability and research. I think in every country it's going to be different, as in every culture, as in every industry. So it really depends on who's embraced the academic point of view and understood how research really affects the bottom line revenue. So I can't really answer that question except to say that there's some very valid research organizations that are doing a lot of work, but I think probably if you look at it, it's probably very similar to what's happening in the U.S. where not all of our clients buy in, and some of them do depending on industry and what they've seen in the past that really works. So we've seen HP, we've seen Adobe, we've seen Microsoft, we've seen Intel, we've seen a lot of these large corporations embrace methodologies applied to ethnography and social research and all these things to begin to see future trends. A lot of people are trending into 5 and 10 years and 15 years into the future, and so they're counting on this type of research to really set their vision for where the company is going to be leading. And then that's very important, but on a day-to-day basis, I think it's less so.
Is that talked about much at Blogger, Doug? Because, I mean, you know, we keep Farsi, Persian, number two language in blogging. I mean, I presume you have to start thinking about non-English users.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, internationalization is becoming one of the, I think, the hottest topics in design, as far as at least my kind of little niche goes, because we have to consider that so heavily in early design. Because, for example, we can't make buttons as images anymore. You have to allow for really long strings of German text sometimes, because they're incredibly long. And it's not just obviously changing text as well. I mean, there are huge cultural significances of color and imagery and things like that, to where it really helps to have regional offices that understand those cultures and can help you translate designs before you even really start designing.
And there's that feature where you have to be able to automatically translate common internationally used words back into French.
One of the interesting things that I think one of the proofs that software, you know, what you talked about, engineering decisions determine social outcomes, and that when you make a software decision, that often affects the sociology of the product that you're, so the software product that you're creating, and vice versa. You won't be adopted unless you fit the sociology. And so two great examples of that are Blogger, which has huge use in Iran, and Orkut, which Google created, and nobody used it anywhere in the world except Brazil, which is completely non-intentional. And they suddenly had no idea what the heck was going on in their own product because they didn't speak Portuguese. And they had to hire Portuguese speakers to tell them what their users were doing with their own product. And they never quite figured out why nobody anywhere else in the world was using it. But there's certain things when you go and look at the Brazilian Orkut pages and stuff like that, there's an awful lot of pictures of shirtless hunks at the beach. And you can sort of get the idea that there's something sociological going on in Brazil that the software is perfectly fitting the needs of, that somehow the software just happened to slot into this perfectly. But I don't even know if Google has figured that out yet, what that is.
If technology has this sociological impact, I wonder what any of you think. You know, if the move to web standards happens, if everyone's got open APIs and that kind of thing, What's the cultural and social impact of that? How does that change the world? Is that too hard?
I can speak a little bit, even though my technical knowledge runs at a certain limit. But it continues to enable more and more grassroots things happening. It's not just the large companies that are owning content publishing and distribution anymore. APIs open up the chance for anyone to write anything and to suddenly create a product or an extension or anything on the web that becomes extremely popular and picked up by millions of people within a matter of sometimes weeks or days. So it just continues to open up this idea that anyone can be creating from anywhere in the world. And that means that it's not just people from either the US or Europe that are contributing, it's people from literally anywhere. It can be, you know, a remote corner of New Zealand, South Africa, it can be anywhere, India. And they're making huge impacts. And it's not just small scale, it's not centralized anywhere. There's massive decentralization happening. And it's really exciting to see that creative ideas are coming around from all over the world. So culturally, it impacts us because it opens up all new kinds of influences so that the American market isn't just saturated with big American media companies anymore. We're seeing influences from all over the world, and that's really exciting.
How much of a fly in the ointment is copyright, intellectual property laws? Because it seems to be a real weak point in any kind of development. I mean, BitTorrent, I love it. It's so exciting to be able to pull in TV from all over the world, but I know it's illegal. Is there any way around this? Because when you look at what Warner Video have just done, we're going to use BitTorrent except with DRM, and it just doesn't work. Is there anything we can do about this?
I mean, I was just going to comment on the same things you just mentioned, from Napster over to the billions of dollars that iPod's making. DRM is something that is on the tips of everyone's tongue, especially because companies are trying to monetize everything that's going on, the trends and everything else. And so the success of Apple and iTunes really shows, I mean, scarily or sadly, or maybe it's a good thing, I don't really know, and I've opened it up to conversation, whether it's a success that they found a way to monetize it or, you know, what's going on. I think there is some truth that people are willing to pay for what's legal as long as it's something that's reasonable, and you get into micropayments and understanding how micropayments work, and I think that's something that's probably going to pop up in the next 2 years, that more and more revenue is going to be drawn from cents and portions of dollars and portions of cents even, and that's going to be probably the next big movement in terms of understanding how to monetize this type of behavior.
But I mean, I can recall talking about micropayments 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Why did it take so long? If it's going to happen soon.
Yeah, well, every company, I mean, we worked with Bank of America 5 years ago on understanding, you know, just certain even credit card formats and things like that. It's all about standardization, and I think that a monopoly or a group, excuse me, of people in Europe got together and they tried to do SimPay, which was a mobile standard for payment using their mobile phones. And that worked for about 2 years, and then all of a sudden one person pulled out because they had developed their own technology and they were able to do it faster. Then all of a sudden it split again. So it's just based on what keeps us going, which is competition. But the standardization of that type of payment is really what's affecting us. So do we have one big person that's calling the shots and then that's scary, or do we consider to, you know, keep it kind of broken apart so that we can't have any standards at all? And that's, again, a point of discussion. Is that good or bad?
Yeah. Even iTunes hasn't really solved the problem completely. If I go up on iTunes or the Apple Music Store and buy 10 albums, I could get one email receipt a couple of days later with 10 items in it if they're all licensed to the same, through the same distributor, or I could get 10 if they're
each from
10.
It's huge. It's a huge problem.
Yeah, I mean, there's got to be a way to make that more liquid.
I wanted to address your question about the web standards thing. Web standards is one of those phrases that I was involved with the Web Standards Project. We went through a phase where we initially it was very easy to just talk about what was a web standard. It was HTML. It was CSS. We had kind of a waffling on whether JavaScript really counted as a web standard because, yeah, there was ECMA script, which didn't really define JavaScript or the various DOMs or anything like that. It was like, you know, well, this is what our low-level number format is going to be, and so on and so forth. So it was really kind of pointless for us to talk about trying to push support for JavaScript as a web standard because there weren't any real standards efforts towards getting IE DOM until, you know, the W3C actually adopted most of IE DOM as the DOM. And we go through this wave every couple of years where the folks on the steering committee debate what exactly constitutes a web standard. And it's easy to go from CSS 1 to CSS 2 to 2.1 to 3 and say, well, they're all web standards. It's very difficult to say, well, what about RSS? Do we really want to get in that mess? You know, does Atom count? Because they're doing, you know, and we have these debates back and forth because there's always somebody who is interested in helping push a given standard, and they look to us as some sort of, you know, launch pad for their effort. And one of the things, I guess, I would go meta on the question and say that things like microformats, things like Atom trying to solve the RSS, you know, quagmire. The key thing to understand or to notice
adding,
about that,
pouring some warm mud on the hole.
Yeah, I know exactly. Oh, you're on fire here. The cool thing is that 20 years ago, it probably wouldn't have been 50 people around the world getting together and saying, "Hey, let's define a standard. Let's document and publish and request, you know, information from other interested parties, see what we're missing, see what we got wrong." But, you know, it is happening now, and it's kind of it's just absolutely gratifying to me to feel like anything that I had to do with the Web Standards Project and bringing the idea of standards just in general to the fore of people's thinking, regardless of what it was that they were doing with them, to get it to the point where people are actually sitting down and thinking, we want widespread adoption, we want a great product or whatever it is, we want this, we want that. And instead of saying, let's form a company and move to, you know, Mountain View, some of them are saying, let's publish this and get some feedback and then, you know, document it and make it freely available, like, you know, FOAF or Atom or anything like that. It's interesting to see that emphasis.
The process you're talking about still remains really different in kind from the way standards are set in just about every other sector. Mm-hmm. I mean, telecommunications, the ITU, associated with the United Nations, top down, this is what's going to happen.
Well, the speed of change is definitely accelerating. I mean, you know, back when they first built the internet, it was a matter of years before you had enough working implementations that someone would get around and document what they all sort of agreed upon eventually over time. Nowadays, you got RSS is like, what, 7 years old? And there are already four different competing versions, and now there's Atom, which is supposed to fix all the problems with the competing versions. I mean,
it's fifth version. One of the things I think that really hurts web standards, and it's not going to be fixed, is Postel's law, which says be liberal in what you accept and strict in what you admit.
You missed my presentation. Postel's law is dead.
Yeah.
but see that in both presentations.
Yes, and this is and I but this is absolutely the reason this is. This stuff never works, is because unless you're not only do you have to be strict, you have to be Mark Pilgrim strict. You have to find all kinds of things wrong with the RSS feed when it has Unicode characters in it that are illegal Unicode combinations, because if you don't, then somebody will do that.
Right.
and so it was really a very hard.
But with the increased communication, don't you think that those things can be isolated and fixed early on enough that it's?
Well, what do you mean by increased communication? If, for example, the El Al Israel Airlines website does not conform to some standard and therefore cannot be consumed correctly by some RSS reader somewhere in some particular situation, and that particular programmer worked for an outsourced company that they hired to build this one website, and the management of El Al thought that they would hire this company and they would finish it and then go away, and so that company no longer works there, and in fact he has left and is now working in the poetry department of the local university, it's never going to get fixed. Mm-hmm. That particular thing is never going to get fixed. You know, ever. So there's certain, you know, when you're in this, you get into this world, when you actually think about standards, think about how often common standards fail. If it's the standard of how to plug a jack into the wall to get power, all right, we have 120 and 240, we really have 110, we have 50 hertz, we have 60 hertz, there's several different countries, but fine, let's just take in the United States, where there are two slightly different standards, nobody realizes this, but sometimes one of the plugs is wider than the other plug. And then people start making these big power bricks that you need to plug in, and they're attached to the plugs. And when you plug the whole thing in, sometimes it covers up something else, and sometimes it doesn't. So even the things that are supposed to be the most standardized, the amount of things that you need to standardize in order to have a standard work is far greater than you actually think right. it really is. And so to the extent that JavaScript is a standard, that's wonderful, and that we have the web standards, that's great. And our development work is 100% XHTML compliant, and we use CSS, you know, almost exclusively. And we use standard JavaScript, and we test in Safari, Opera, Firefox, and IE, and probably 50% of my developers' time is spent fixing these little, working around these little Opera bugs. Or Safari bugs in things that if you went and tried to find a standard for that particular thing, you would realize that this whole area has completely fallen between the cracks. The person who wrote that document wasn't really thinking about that particular issue at that particular time. Yeah, it is sort of a miracle that HTTP survived and works. TCP/IP. Yeah, you know, there was sort of, the truth is when you have two or three large implementations talking to each other, then other people will test against them and it'll be okay. But actually, HTTP is a great example because HTTP replaced, does anybody remember?
Gopher.
But what the actual HTTP transfer protocol replaced the previous file transfer protocol we had, which was called FTP. And FTP was extremely hard to automate because it was assumed that you would be using an FTP client that could display messages. And so the FTP client said that you're allowed to issue a directory command, but it didn't say anything about what format the result would be in. And because the spec said nothing about the format of that command, the early implementers of FTP servers would run an LS or a DIR or whatever it was on their local server, and whatever crap came out, they would just dump down the pipe, and good luck. And then there were 60 different FTP servers running on 60 different, slightly different species of Unix. And if you want to write an FTP client that can actually enumerate what files are out there, the standard couldn't help you. It didn't say anything about that. When you got an error message, the spec said, well, you get a number, and the first digit of the number meant something and nothing else meant anything. And then some text which told you what to do, which could be written in any language you wanted, and basically needed to be shown to a human being who understood English to deal with that. And that just wasn't good enough to automate the clients. You couldn't automate the clients. And HTTP basically said, okay, here's, it's connectionless, and it solved that particular problem, just because for the first time it was a spec that chopped off all the stuff that wasn't specified and left you with something that was clearly
specified. But I would argue, I mean, in defense of my the idea that the increase in communication and increase in involvement, basically, the whole idea of a critical mass of people who care about a certain thing, the success of a certain thing, with HTTP is a prime example. HTTP 1.0 did not have any conception of virtual hosts. Right. There was nothing built into 1.0 that would allow you to have multiple hosts.
So that means
names,
basically two URLs on the same physical box.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So right. One IP, multiple names, and some way of switching into different contexts based on some information.
Yeah, HTTPS still doesn't.
HTTPS still doesn't, right.
Yeah.
And I think that's just broken. It's going to stay broken because
it has to,
socket
has to stay broken.
It's a long enough answer there because I'm sure there's some other questions.
Yeah, well,
next. Well, no, I'm conscious of time. We've got 10 minutes to go.
I'll just say one thing.
Okay.
One of the nice things about it was that people recognized it early enough and said, Roy Fielding got together with a few folks and said, ooh, this isn't going to work because the web is growing faster than we thought. We're going to run out of IP addresses. I mean, that problem sort of went away with the introduction of CIDR and so forth. But they introduced and agreed on, they got all the vendors together and said, okay, we've got to have a way for the browser to send the host that we're expecting back. They have invented the host header, and that's the basis of virtual hosting now.
Right.
And they implemented it before they had a spec ready.
Right.
All of the browsers.
Actually, that's a very important point, is that the specs at work are always going to be post after the implementation. When you try to do a spec before the implementation, which I think Adam kind of tried to do, it doesn't work as well as when you're merely documenting something that's already understood.
I did an interview with Jamie Zawinski for developer.com that you may be able to find, I don't know, if archive.org or something like that, but where we debated that, because the IETF is definitely a, let's go ahead and discuss what we want to do, and everybody tries an implementation, and we kind of hash out the rough edges, and then we get something that everybody can mostly agree on, and we'll write that up, and everything else that's created after that will conform, as best as it can, versus the W3C approach, where it's like, well, we are pronouncing this spec what you should follow. And then everybody has to kind of run behind and say, do we really want to devote the resources to getting 2.1 implemented,
right.
so on and so forth. And I think that the places where the web standards fail, they fail on the basis of that. I argued with Jamie at the time that things were moving faster than they used to and so on and so forth, and it actually made sense for there to be a forum where everybody could come in and communicate. But it was interesting to talk to him about it because his take was very much very skeptical of the W3C approach.
And right. There used to be in the days of email where they were trying to get email products to interoperate with each other.
Yeah, come on, I'm going to stop you both, actually, because that was just getting way too geeky, even for this audience.
Doug and I design type. We're type designers. That's, that's the old world that we come from.
I was going to ask you about that, but... No. Yes, Roger. Just shout. Any comments?
You're all looking at me.
The question was whether we had any comments on WCAG 2, which is nearing, basically running towards the end of public commentary period before it becomes issued as a recommendation, and that it... I just say that one of the that shows up one of the problems with the W3C. I think it's great that we have it. I think that it, things would be a lot worse without it. But I also think that there are a lot of folks at the W3C who are basically, they have their pet drum, they have their favorite pet project, and they bang that drum as loud as they can. I mean, a good example is XHTML 1.1. Okay. I talk to people on the web design list and other places, and they're like, well, you know, I'm using the very latest standard because I'm using XHTML 1.1, and they're just completely confused by the version numbering thing. 1.1 is this weird evolutionary dead end that Murray Altheim came up with because he's this genius SGML DTD expert that was supposed to be a way of chopping up HTML into little bits so you could say, when you get a request from a mobile phone, it could say, I don't actually support forms, so somehow, apparently, I don't know how this was supposed to work, but it was supposed to be such that the server could say, oh, well, you know, I'm sorry that you don't support forms, I won't bother to send any form tags back to you. You know, it was a pipe dream to begin with, and I don't think it was a success. I don't think anybody who is using it really understands why it was constructed the way that it is, or whatever value it has. And you see a lot of that. The folks that made, you know, the money to buy their first yacht building SGML applications in the 80s, a lot of them moved into XML and the web in the 90s, hoping to pay for the first yacht or, you know, buy the second yacht. And a lot of them really never did anything else except continue to bang that drum.
And I'm going to ask one for the designers in the audience. Your interface people, so both of you. What fascinates me is that you know, over the years I've you know, repeatedly heard people say, you know, talk about the future of interfaces, talk about gesture-based computing, talk about, you know, the way things are going to change, and we're really still pointing and clicking, aren't we? You know, is any of that going to change?
iPod.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think it's already starting to change. I've been talking about this for about the past year with different people, but... I think to see the future of interface design and interfaces in general, we all need to look to generations behind us, because we're too stuck in the patterns that we're used to and accustomed to. But if you look at the kids coming up behind us and what they're accustomed to and what their world consists of, they're used to a world that has, number one, it's always been connected. Their content has always, or whatever they create, is always their own. They don't have to worry necessarily about pointing and clicking. Like, their interface is well beyond keyboards and mice by now. They jump in front of TVs and they punch and bat each other in virtual spaces. And their acceptance of these kind of gestural forms of interfaces are much quicker and broader than what we're used to. So those kids, once they get into high school, college, they're going to be inventing things that we can't even imagine right now. And they'll gain rapid adoption because it's just what they all know and what they've been used to, whether it's gaming or education or the experiences that they have now. And in fact, to get kids involved in testing UI and things and in actually even helping design is going to be, I think, a really big step. Only because they're going to be the future of what we're used to, and it's going to be inventing things that we can't even imagine.
Because, I mean, one thing that strikes me about my kids is they've grown up with the absolute assumption that they can copy and repeat media, you know, as has everyone who's grown up with a video recorder, whereas I think we probably all were children before there were video recorders. I mean, what difference does that make? I mean, it's that future of the internet thing.
Well, video specifically, I don't really have a comment on right now. I was just thinking a little bit more towards what Doug was talking about. A lot of what we're looking at right now is how interface, I mean, we're talking about interfacing with different things. And I had in my talk this little grid, and I'll just repeat it quickly. There's machine-to-machine communication, human-to-machine communication, human-to-human communication, and that's all good and fine. But the part that's being refined right now is the machine-to-human communication and making sure that that's really relevant. And so that's what we see changing over and over. I had the opportunity to go to something we call the Sony Metreon that's in San Francisco. It's a very cool adult hangout. Kids hang out too, but it's sort of an adult, you know, place for technology to be shown and all this. And there's these little Aibo dogs. Have you seen those? And in theory, they act like real dogs, and you can command them to do things, and they actually display emotions. And it's fascinating to see the first generation of that and probably how that's going to evolve over time. So we're going to be interacting with things more and more that feel more lifelike, that respond to us. And you know, AI is a great example. I was speaking to someone who was doing a thesis on looking at movies and technology and how that's going to integrate with our lives. So you just look sometimes to film to see what's out there and how some of the things in the 30s and 40s and 50s came to be, and now we're looking to the future, and we'll probably be seeing those things in short time.
Right.
Also on that concept, and especially at the Metreon as well, I noticed that there's at the Sony Metreon, there's this interactive exhibit, which is definitely telling of how people accept technology. To where it's on the floor, it's a projected interface, but you can interact with it. You can step on it, you can move your hands, you can pop popcorn, you can play air hockey, things like that, and it constantly changes. And when you stand back and just kind of watch crowds approach it, adults are often very hesitant to interact with it. They just kind of stand on the edge and kind of try to figure out, and they might kind of put their foot in, kind of like they're testing the water. But kids run up and just jump right up on top of it, and they're real excited to play around with it, and they figure it out immediately. Like, there's no hesitation whatsoever in approaching these types of interactions.
Yeah.
And so when you think about, what was the movie with the concept of future crime with Tom Cruise? Mm-hmm. Was it Tom Cruise? Minority Report.
Yeah.
You think back when that movie came out, we kind of laughed at it among UI mailing lists. We thought, oh, there are never going to be interfaces like that where you grab things and move them all around. But kids are already thinking like that in the gamings that they're doing, in the education spaces that they're doing. So things like that are just going to become more and more prevalent.
Yep. Yeah, my 11-year-old brought home a kid who had never played World of Warcraft before. You know, and I haven't actually met one of those before. And he sat him down in front of it, and the kid just started playing it. Yeah, I was astonished that, but you know, there was something there that I really, because I look at World of Warcraft and it just looks really confusing. You know, I don't know what's going on. Anyway, we had someone who's been trying to ask a question for a while over here.
I was just wondering what you guys think about Creative Commons and if that is going to have any impact, especially on the internet being free and open and all.
Yeah, the Creative Commons movement. Do we have thoughts on it? No,
it's a depressing commentary on how screwed up copyright law is in the States at the very least. I mean, the fact that Lessig has basically built a career out of pointing out how screwed up it is that Disney stole all of its original stories from the Grimm brothers because they didn't have that protection. Now they're, you know, extending the copyright out 120 years. It just makes me sad. And I... But it's cool that there's a framework in which you can actually, and it's cool that there's a framework that they can actually give legal protection to certain kinds of content, and it's even cooler, like if you look at Flickr or if you look at some of these other services, that they've built that in. Like when I upload a picture to Flickr, it gives me an opportunity to say, you know, I want this open Creative Commons license, I want this copyleft, I want this and this and this, and you can actually, it's integrating it into the process, not necessarily of content creation, but of content sharing. And I think that's where it's going to really have an impact, is that it's kind of like the GNU copyleft. You've got this idea where you can choose a license. You know, it doesn't really have any competitors in that space, and I think it's really good that they're doing that, because as soon as you publish, you should be able to make that decision, that control decision, how much control you want over it, how much you want it to be shared, you know, among everyone who wants to share it.
I would actually go out on a limb and say, even though I like Creative Commons and I think it's a great effort, the number of people that care about that kind of stuff for their own works is the same as the number of people that read the dialog box when you install software that says, please read the following terms of service and click I accept. So, you know, there's going to be 1 in 1,000, basically the copyright geeks and the license geeks who just love to get into debates over the distinction between the Mozilla public license and the Apache Berkeley third derivative license, you know, Lutheran version, second synod of 1823.
Well, I see the open source guys are saying that, you know, are starting to say that the problem is with the Creative Commons licenses is that they're too vague, is that they actually don't nail things down enough, and they're going to have to become more like open source software licenses, where what you can and can't do is very clearly defined.
I don't think it's so clear for open source licenses either. I mean, the Berkeley license is a few sentences. Nobody really quite knows what that means. These things haven't really been tested. At the time that the GPL was written, there was a certain understanding of how programs worked with other programs, and now programs are combined in all kinds of different ways and packaged in all kinds of different ways, and, you know, quick download that thing from the internet to be used in my program. So they're still pretty vague, too.
There's a great Scientific American article that came out 3 or 4 years, well, 5, 6, 7 years ago, that shows just how screwed up things are. It talks about proxy servers. Basically, if lawyers wanted to really bring class action lawsuits against anyone running a large-scale proxy server, because it makes a temporary copy in the cache or in memory before it, you know, allows it to be transmitted on or so on and so forth. That one really kind of galvanized me, because I talked to some folks and I was just like, that's crazy, I can't believe they published that in Scientific American. I was all up in arms, and they said, yeah, but legally, they're right. If you apply the existing law to this situation, they could make a case. And that's when I started to sweat. You know, that was when it was like, wow, this is really behind the times. People have no idea the impact of highly connected communities on what used to be something that governed books, you know?
We've actually got pending alterations to our Copyright Act, which make a specific exemption for transient copying. Various things like that, and I think Microsoft objected.
can we borrow some of your legislators when we're done with them?
We've got a digital strategy that actually mentions the words Creative Commons. But Miraz has been standing there for quite some time, and I think we've run over time. Thanks very much. Sorry we didn't get quite as many questions from the floor, but thank you all.